Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 240 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Rick Stroud speaks with Robin Blake about how his filmmaking background influences his literary projects, his fascination with World War II and the projects it has led him to, and his love of simple, clear writing.
Rick Stroud is a filmmaker turned historian of the Second World War. His books, all written in a very clear, elegant style, cover the deception campaign underpinning Montgomery's victory at Alamein, the sensational kidnap by partisans and British agents of a German general in Nazi-occupied Crete, and the exploits of women of the Special Operations Executive in occupied France. Rick has also worked with an old soldier, Victor Gregg, on a set of very extraordinary war memoirs. He lives on a houseboat on the River Thames, where we met to talk about fighting and writing.
Rick, you switched from being a filmmaker to being a writer. Was that a big change in your life? It must be, because making films is more a business of working with other people, isn't it?
What happened to me was that I'd finished a film. This is about 8 years ago, and I was at a New Year's Eve party talking to a writer called Justin Picardy. Justin was writing a book for Bloomsbury, and we were talking about another Bloomsbury book called Moondust, which was about, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was about the 12 men who'd walked on the moon. And I said that I thought that the best book about the moon was Norman Mailer's Fire on the Moon, which is about the Apollo 11 mission. So exciting was it that when I read it, when it came to the business of landing on the moon, I physically shook at Mailer's description. It was a very visceral experience. And I added, as we were chatting, that I didn't think that the final book had been written about the moon. And Justin said, why don't you write one? This was a new idea, and she said, we can write it together. So we began to work together, and that quickly became clear that that was not going to work, because she was finishing another book. She wasn't as interested in it as I was. And so we agreed to part, but I was always grateful for Justin for giving me the idea. I wrote a proposal very quickly, which my wife, Alexandra, is always my first reader, and it was good to get her input. And then I sent it to a literary agent who was a friend, Victoria Hobbs, and Victoria sold it, I mean, beginner's luck really, within almost 2 weeks here and in America. And so I began to write that, and it had to be written in time to coincide with an anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. And I was offered some work, television work, during the writing period, but I couldn't possibly meet my writing deadline and do the directing. And the thing about directing is it's a very, very absorbing piece of knitting. And when you wrap at the end of the day, you can't just walk home and forget it, because you have to do more work for the next day, and B, it inhabits your mind. Imaginatively, takes up a lot of space, and you know, when you finish a film, the film goes on in your head for sometimes months afterwards. And an example of this is that with my late first wife, I came back from making a film in Morocco, and she'd had the house redecorated, and I didn't notice. I mean, I was so absorbed in the film was with John Hurt. It was a very great, intense experience. So I turned down work that was offered to me during that time. And of course, in show business, if you turn down work, they very quickly think you're dead or you've gone away. And so the offers of work began to dry up. But simultaneously with that, I had another... When I finished the Book of the Moon, which is really an anthology about the moon from moon rock to magic, which I researched it in the British Library, because that had the sort of science... The science collection, the moon collection, the astronomical collection is enormous, and I spent a very happy 18 months in Science 3, right at the top, learning really how to write a protracted piece of prose, and I think it turned out at just over 100,000 words, and that was the beginning of writing simultaneously with that. I wanted to write a novel set in the Second World War, and I was researching that novel. In fact, I wrote the novel. Nobody's ever bought it, so this is a bit of a slight waste of time. I still wish the novel somebody might pick it up again. But in researching that, I met a man who'd been in the Western Desert. He'd been a captain, and he said to me, "Oh, you've got to meet Vic Gregg." And Vic Gregg was a soldier who had an amazing war. And I went to talk to Vic, and he was very suspicious of me because he's a rifleman. He left school at 14, born in King's Cross, and I, in his book, am a toff, which means I'm an authority figure, which means he wouldn't trust me because of his experiences. But we talked for a whole morning, and then he showed me a manuscript that he'd written 20 years before. He was, I think, 90 by then, for his grandchildren about the war. And the manuscript was incomprehensible, but it was slap bang in the middle of the period that I wanted to write about and have written about, including his own experiences at the Battle of Arnhem. And for years and years and years, I have wanted to write about or be involved with something to do with Arnhem. So suddenly being confronted with Vic Gregg, who'd been at Arnhem, as well as with lots of other places, but and had been in the rear guard at Arnhem, and who had been captured and sentenced to death for trying to sabotage, or in fact successfully sabotaging a soap factory, condemned to death, held in Dresden overnight in a prison with 500 other men prior to being executed, and that was the night we bombed it. But ironically, my uncle was in the air and bombing it, and one of the bombs blew the prison apart, and Vic got out. So he showed this manuscript had all this stuff in it, which is slap bang in the middle of what I think about all the time.
Is there any reason for that, do you think? I mean, where do you think that comes from? Is it from tales from your father's war or anything like that?
No, because my father was he was an electronics engineer, and he was in a, I think it's called a reserved profession. And I believe, this is what he said, that he worked on radar. So the nearest he got to action was one day he was on a battleship or some sort of big naval thing, and it sailed with him and other electricians or technicians on board. Although my uncle was in the Royal Air Force in Bomber Command, but there's no real history in my family of war. I don't know where it comes from. When I was at school, I was in the cadet force, and I was being promoted at one point so quickly in that it, had it gone on, I would have been a brigadier by the time I left. And I loved the Corps, although when I got into the sixth form, I left it out of rage and, you know, a typical adolescent protest, and joined the anti-war, anti-Vietnam marches in London. But no, I've no idea where it comes from.
But you have written, apart from your book on the moon, I think all your books are history or narrative histories of aspects of the war.
They're narrative history of aspects of the war, that's exactly right. And what I like to do is to find some small incident that I can research in detail and then write about it. So what I've written about is the camouflage unit in the Western Desert, which was a small group of artists and filmmakers who took part in the last physical deception, or real physical deception of the war, a thing called Operation Bertram, where they pretended that there was a big, I think they created out of balsa wood and bits of string, literally, two British divisions, including an armoured division, using their skills as set builders and painters to design this stuff, which was never seen close up, but it was seen from 1,000 feet in the air or from a 1,000 yards distance by Germans with field glasses.
So these were fake tanks.
They were fake tanks.
Field artillery and things like that.
Tanks, fake field artillery, fake railways made out of beaten up tin cans. I mean, they were highly ingenious men, and they created the illusion that the British, when the British attack came, which they knew was going to come, that it would come 40 miles to the south of where it was actually going to come. And the sort of coup de théâtre that they pulled off was that overnight, they created a, if this makes sense, they created a force, they parked a lot of lorries within sight of the Germans, and they parked a lot of tanks just out of sight of the Germans. And the Germans knew that whilst the tanks were parked where they could see them, the attack couldn't happen because, you know, the attack couldn't happen without tanks. And overnight, using false tanks and false lorries, they swapped them over. So in the morning when the Germans woke up, there were the lorries still parked there, and there were the tanks still parked there. But what they didn't realise that these lorries were now just covers for tanks, and that the...
The real tanks had moved to another part of the front.
No, the real tanks were now underneath the lorries. They swapped the real lorries for the real tanks. So instead of harmless soft-skin lorries within a mile of where the Germans were, there were tanks disguised as lorries. And they did that overnight, which is an incredible piece of magic, really. So that was what interested me about that was the little group of artists who all came from the Royal College and the Chelsea School of Art, etc.
Some quite well-known names. Edward Wadsworth, I think, is one.
Yeah, they were very, very, very well-known at the time. And they all collaborated to make this deception. And one of the nice things for me was that one of the men was called Fred Pusey, who was a film designer. And without knowing that one day I'd be writing about Fred, I worked with Fred's son, John, who designed a series that I did. The next book I wrote was about the capture of General Kreiper.
On the subject of German generals again, yes.
On the subject of German generals by a hooligan called, or a hooray called Patrick Lee Fermor, who was a hysterical man who was obsessed with daring do and had a plan to capture a monstrous general. And before he could execute the plan, that monstrous general was taken off Crete, which is where they were all operating. And nevertheless, Patrick Lee Fermor said, well, we must capture it. Any German general will do. His successor will do. And they captured him. And
Patrick Lee Fermor, of course, is a very well-known travel writer and so on. And he wrote his own account of this. But was that not published? Because I've got a feeling that wasn't published till after he died. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely right. It was published at the same time as my book, actually. A lot of it is quite sort of fantastical and made up in that very purple. I find his prose almost impossible to read. Other people love it. I mean, he's a much loved person, but I've got my sort of doubts about him.
But you've delivered a very different sort of book, because your writing style is plain and direct, isn't it, rather
yes.
than embellished.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, and I believe that when we as fellows talk to students, what I say is that there is no such thing as academic English. There is only good English, which is applied to academic work, to a novel, to a handbook, or whatever. And this is my view, is that what you should aspire to are short sentences. Don't use polysyllabic words, avoid adverbs, be very careful with adjectives, and don't use subclauses. And that's the sort of generator behind my own style of writing, which is the reverse of Lee Fermor's, which is very ebullient and padded and purple.
I can see reasons why, a personal memoir would have a different approach to writing style compared to what you're doing and to writing of narrative history, where clarity is, the crucial thing.
Yes, but I mean, I personally think clarity is everything in any sort of writing, and I believe in plain English. I think it's the be-all and end-all of writing. Not everybody agrees.
When you were working with Victor Gregg, the rifleman who had an amazing war that you were talking about earlier, that I presume wasn't publishable in its form,
no.
You had to. Did you rework it? What did you do?
I mean, what Vic handed me was a very long, totally chaotic manuscript with all the pages were out of order. I mean, physically it was chaotic. The pages were out of order. It was printed double sided. Some sides were upside down, and there were no page numbers, so it was impossible to. It took a long time to just get them in roughly the right order. But even when they were in the right order, Vic left school at 14. He can't write comprehensible English. And so being a film director, and by this time I'd written a novel, a smash hit unpublished novel, and two books that had been published, I channeled Vic. I knew a great deal about the time that he was writing about the war in the desert and then in northeast Europe. And I rewrote his stuff and rewrote it and simplified it, but in the voice of Vic. And I spent a lot of time with Vic, and I got to know him, I still do know him very, very well. And I brought a lot of my own experience to it without, I think, betraying Vic, although Vic could never see. He said, oh, I mean, I'll try and imitate him. He said, "Oh, Rick," he said, why didn't you correct all my grammar and everything? Because I thought that's what you were meant to do. And I said, "Look, Vic, I went to Oxford and you left school when you were 14. If I corrected your grammar, it would suddenly turn into the prose of an Oxford graduate. And the interest in this work is the life of Vic Gregg, Victor Gregg." And he could never quite see that. And he always thought that word count was very, very important. He said, "You've cut 50,000 of my words." He said, "My mates think we should have put them all back in because they're interesting." And I said, "Vic, if we put them all back in, nobody would publish it."
In my experience, it's very easy to fall out with people during this process, and I've done it two or three times myself.
Yes.
And on one occasion I can think of, you know, I fell out with the guy three times, and he came back because he didn't have another way of doing the book.
I never fell out with Vic because I decided that my role, as far as he was concerned, was to be his servant, his aide-de-camp, and I used to call him Sir. I mean, as a joke. And I always deferred to him. And that was great because that defused the idea that I was the tough authority figure. And he thought that he could make me do whatever he wanted. And I conspired in that. So.
It's a very different thing to write history when you can talk to people who lived it, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And I can see that as a filmmaker, that's something that you would also have regarded as rather important.
Very important, because being a filmmaker, I do tend to write very visually. I mean, that's just the way I can't not. You know, I like telling a story.
But the wartime stories that you've told so far have all concerned men. But your most recent book is about women in war, isn't it? Tell us about that.
The book is called Lonely Courage, and it's about the women of, technically, it's about the women of F Section of the Special Operations Executive. And F Section was the French section. And you know the way in one's life you have things that you'd quite like to write about. And years ago I'd written a list of things that I wanted to write about. I mean, when I was 26 or 27 and making my way as a director in television. And one of those women was a woman called the Princess Noor Khan, Noor Inayat Khan. And also as a young boy I'd read in the Eagle comic, a serialisation of a book called Carve Her Name with Pride, which is about Violette Szabo. So these women had been in my head, and they've all been written about. I mean, Claire Mullie's written about them, Shivani Basu's written about Noor Khan, but nobody had written a sort of narrative about what happened to them. And I chose six women who really chose themselves. I couldn't do any research with real-life SOE agents because they were pretty much all dead or not able to speak. You know, they'd become ill. And I'm talking about two or three women at the most, or their families didn't want them to be subjected to somebody like me coming to talk to them. So I had to do it all through the National Archive and that sort of thing. But I chose six of these women. I thought, well, what I'll do is I will tell this as a chronological narrative, which was a very, very complicated thing to do because I started the research thinking, as a lot of people do when they start research, that I had to do all the research before I began to write. I no longer think that is true. And I made a timeline of all the people that I thought were interesting or important to the stories. And that timeline covered every week of the war, and then went on, in places it covered every day of the war, and in some cases it covered every hour of every day of the war. You know, the x-axis or whatever it is down the right left-hand side was about 100 long, and the y-axis was also very, very long, and it was I couldn't print it, and it was very difficult to scan it, I mean to look at it even on the computer. And so I thought the only thing I can do now is to start to write, and that will tell me who is important. I knew the really important people were my six leading characters, which I think turned into seven. And two things emerged. A, what was already known, which is that they were extraordinarily brave, and yet they were ordinary people. I mean, they just came from ordinary walks of life, or from every walk of life, because another actually was a countess, Christina Skarbek, Polish countess. And the other thing that emerged through telling the story chronologically, and that was the point of the timeline, was to get the chronology. So I wouldn't write anything. I wouldn't say, and she would then go on to become. I would only write about what we knew about her at any given point, or any of them at any given point in time. And what that threw into sharp relief was that they were very badly led by the three people in Baker Street, which is where the SOE had its headquarters. I mean, shockingly badly led, and especially by a man called Maurice Buckmaster, who was in charge of F section, who committed some really crass, made some very bad mistakes or incompetence, and one of which was to hire as his second in command a man who had been in touch with the Nazis, and to hire as his air landing officer in France, a Frenchman who was in the pay of the Gestapo, who had a Gestapo number, and who, for every agent that he betrayed, he would get X 1,000 francs.
Do you feel as a writer you tend to lose objectivity when you hear something like that? I mean, you get angry about it.
Well, yes, I mean, Buckmaster had written his own account of it, which was made it all seem like, you know, everything was under control. Other people who've read the book go, my goodness, that Buckmaster chap. I, reader of your book, Rick, get angry reading about it. And I met a man the other day who said, oh, Buckmaster, he said, yes, I worked with him after the war. He was something to do with some advertising guild. He was chairman of it. And he said it was so useless that we had to fire him. And this is a man who is quite revered. I mean, there are people who talk about Buck and who won't have a word said against him. But yes, I mean, I got very... When I finished my first draft, I emailed my wife saying I feel very, very emotional when I put the end, because I've sort of finished my... Although there was a lot of redrafting to do, I've come to the end of the journey, first time round, with these women. And I've left some of them in concentration camps, some of them dying, some of them sitting in bars in London. The war is over. And I really miss them. And I did feel... I mean, I think all writers get that, novelists or non-fiction writers, that when they finish a journey with some characters, they are slightly bereft for... You know, those characters are no longer going to be in their brains.
I've talked to other filmmakers who are also writers, book writers, and I think of one example of someone who's a novelist. And unlike me, he is the best organised pre-planner, so every chapter is accounted for before he even starts. And this is the last way I want to work. And I wonder, because you said yourself that you changed your mind about whether all the research should be done. So tell me about that. Have you had to sort of slightly change your attitude to the organising the material from moving between films and books?
When you start out to make a film, you have a script which is as good as you can get it. And that's where the director usually starts, unless he's actually or she has written the script themselves. And that script is a very, on one level, is quite a clear set of instructions to the film crew as to how the film should be made, subject to its creative interpretation. In parallel with that script is a schedule, and that schedule shows what must happen by when through the pre-production, the production and the post-production. And knowing that I'm basically chaotic and lazy, what I try to do is to make a schedule. I work out where I want to arrive at a first draft. And I believe all writing, unless you're a genius, starts with the first draft. It's only when you've got a first draft that you can really start writing properly. So I work out where in the time... Say that I've got 2 years to write it. I may put out a marker for the first draft, which for me is about, say, a third or a quarter of the way through. And then I work out the number of words I want to write, say it's 100,000 words, and then I make a list of all the days between the start and the first draft, and then I knock out the weekends, because I know I probably won't write much at weekends, and I knock out things where I know I won't be able to write because I'm going on holiday, going to a party, going to do research, etc., etc. That then leaves me a residue of days which are writing days. And you then divide those days into 100,000. That gives you how many words you have to.
So this is not unlike planning a film where you've got to have a shooting schedule, a shooting script.
It's exactly like that. And I know that if I don't do the work on day one that I plan to do on day one, that work then trickles down through all the rest of the days. And you know, if I look out of the window, that day is lost, and on and on and on. So it's a very good incentive. And I'm schedule driven. I can't not work to a schedule. I'm 70 years old. My entire life has been until I was 60 odd, 62, has been spent working to a schedule, and it feels very, it makes me very jumpy. And when I say to my publishers, what's the schedule, and they go all vague, oh, a little bit around, it makes me incredibly jumpy, because I like things to be pinned down so we know where we stand. That's my writing technique.
Rick Stroud, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Rick Stroud in conversation with Robin Blake. You can find out more about Rick on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 240, which was recorded by Robin Blake and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 241, Susan Barker speaks with Cherise Saywell about the international origins of her novels, the way her characters and storylines emerge organically as she writes, and her experiences living in Japan and China. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.